It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is back with us tomorrow. Coming up, we'll talk to a mathematician about how the laws of probability explain why things that seem improbable happen all the time. First, we're talking about the latest news from this year's Electronic Entertainment Expo. Every year, members of the video game industry get together for this conference known as the E3. Today is the last day. We have technology reporter covering it here to fill us in. Omar Agayaga is with us. He's a technology culture reporter for the Austin American Statesman. Omar, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, tell us, what is the E3 conference?
Well, this is a long-running conference that used to be mostly for press and industry people to kind of get together and show off the latest in video games, but it has really expanded its audience because everything is pretty much now is live-streamed. All of the major big kind of announcements from Microsoft, Sony, your Nintendo's, those are all live on the web. People react to them instantly, so it's become much more of a public event.
Well, and the industry is really big, isn't it? I mean, sometimes you see marquee video games that have a crew and a cost as much as some movies.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting into the era of hundreds of millions of dollars spent on marketing and making video games like your Grand Theft Auto V, which in one day will bring in more money than, you know, any summer Hollywood blockbuster. It's gotten pretty pretty high stakes.
When I think of the electronic gaming world, I think of two main audiences. One, the hardcore gamer who's, you know, daily checking in for updates on the new Grand Theft Auto or what have you. And then a larger but maybe more casual bunch of gamers who play on their phones, their tablets, you know, games that take a few minutes or Words with Friends or something like that. Which side of that is the E3 geared toward?
Definitely the major announcements are more geared toward the hardcore, the people that are going to spend $60 on a video game like your Halos and your Tomb Raider type games. But it's interesting because so much has shifted toward that audience, that casual market of people that are playing on their tablets and their phones and only spending about 99 cents, if that, per game. So, yeah, it's a big challenge for those big video game companies, and they really haven't made inroads in mobile so much as you would expect at this point.
Who are the big players in that industry?
Well, the big three that you see at E3 that are making the huge announcements are Microsoft and Sony, which both had their presentations on Monday, and then Nintendo, which is kind of trailing up third right now. Its Wii U console has really not caught fire, so they've really been struggling of late, whereas the last generation, they were dominant with the Nintendo Wii, so things have really shifted, and really it seems like Sony is kind of in the driver's seat right now with this next generation of video game consoles with the PlayStation 4.
What are the hardcore gamers really looking at in this year's E3?
Well, last year, Microsoft really stumbled at E3. They made an emphasis on the Kinect, the kind of a camera attachment that was previously standard with the Xbox One. They have now separated it, kind of an acknowledgement that that was probably not a great move. Last year, they really focused on streaming, on ESPN. You can do Netflix, you can do this. This year, they really focused on games. They really kind of eschewed all of that to really say, no, we've got games too. It's not just all this other stuff. And I think that was definitely acknowledging Sony, which had a very successful E3 last year and really came out strong with the PlayStation 4, which has been selling much better than the Xbox One. So really, it's kind of a two-person race between Sony and Microsoft, with Nintendo bringing up the rear. And Nintendo, they had some interesting stuff in their presentation, but nothing that I think is really going to turn the tide. I mean, it was more kind of catering toward the people that are already in the tank for Nintendo. So really, Sony was very strong. Microsoft was much stronger than last year. But those were the big three players, I think, so far at E3.
Is there an emphasis on, you know, children and teenage gamers at the E3?
It's funny. I tweeted about that the other night when in the middle of Sony's presentation, they had this wonderful, wonderful demo of Little Big Planet 3, which is an upcoming game that is just gorgeous and wonderful and family friendly. They showed that. I got my kids, you know, to come look at the live stream. Hey, look at this game. This is fantastic. And then immediately after that, they showed a game called Bloodborne, which is the most violent game you're ever going to see on a video game. I was like, kids, get away.
Oh, no.
So, you know, I got a lot of whiplash watching some of these presentations because you have these really charming, great, family friendly games, and then shift to these bloody hardcore shooters. So, you know, it's they're trying to cover all their bases in these, you know, 1-2-3 hour presentations. But by doing that, they're really throwing a lot at the wall and trying to see what people react to and what sticks.
Is this an entertainment industry that hasn't quite grown up yet? Because when you go to see How to Train Your Dragon 2, you're probably not going to see a preview for the newest slasher flick.
No, that's a problem. That's a marketing issue. That's sort of a function of them only having, you know, this one shot to really get everybody's attention and kind of lay all their cards on the table. And especially, you know, Microsoft learned the hard way last year that, you know, if they're off message or they deliver something that gamers don't want, they're going to hear about it and they're going to have to change their strategy. So I think they're all being very cautious this year and really bringing out the big guns, you know, the things people are very familiar with, like Halo and Call of Duty and Metal Gear Solid, the things that the big titles and sequels that I think people are coming to expect, and maybe sneaking in a few kind of indie things. Actually, the game I'm hearing the most buzz about is called No Man's Sky, which nobody saw coming. It's a procedurally generated space game, you know, kind of a flying, and then you're in the sea and going from planet to planet. It's just absolutely gorgeous for the PlayStation 4. Nobody saw it coming. Nobody expected it, and it really kind of stole the show. So sometimes there'll be a surprise, kind of a curveball that you're not expecting, but for the most part, we were seeing a lot of stuff that you could have predicted. You know, another you know, Little Big Planet, another big Halo game, another Tomb Raider, another Call of Duty. It's getting to be pretty repetitive year after year.
Omar, all these things you're talking about seem to be console oriented things you plug into a TV screen. Most of my computer gaming is on a PC. You know, something I have on a desk. Am I a dinosaur?
No, not at all. There's still a huge market for MMO games. There's still, you know, a lot of these games that I mentioned are also going to be on a PC. Microsoft actually did very well with Titanfall, which is also a PC game. So yeah, no, the PC market is actually rebounded. There's been a really big resurgence in indie games for PC. Steam is a great marketplace for video games and has kind of helped revitalize the indie games market. No, there's still a lot happening there. And the elephant in the room that we haven't talked about is Oculus Rift, this virtual reality headset that could be the future of gaming. Sony's got its own sort of take on that, a product called Morpheus, but that won't be out till at least next year. We have no idea how much it'll cost. I mean, it's a little bit further down the line, but Oculus Rift is definitely making gamers think about how games that they're playing now are going to adapt to this kind of virtual reality setup.
Well, you mentioned some companies saying, hey, we got to focus on the game. It's in the game, to quote EA Sports' lead-in. But then Sony, one of the big three you talked about, saying they're creating a TV show. Where's that coming from?
Yeah, they're kind of a little late to the party of that. Microsoft had previously announced a Halo series called Nightfall with Ridley Scott involved. So what Sony is doing, they announced a show called Powers, which is based on a pretty popular graphic novel series by Brian Michael Bendis, and that will, I believe, debut later this year, and it's going to be included with people who are members of PlayStation Plus. So yeah, this is actually the first big original kind of TV content that Sony's been working on. But, you know, it seems like a pretty safe bet for them. It's based on a popular graphic novel. It's about superheroes. You know, it's pretty geek friendly. They're not going out on a huge limb by doing that.
A lot of us got our start in video gaming by putting quarters into slots. And one of those first games was Donkey Kong. The hero, Mario, is still with us. I gather there's a new version of the Mario Kart game that spun off from the spinoffs from Donkey Kong.
Yeah, and that's already out for the Wii U, and it's fantastic. I've been playing it. It's really fun. You can play it online. It's a great, great game, and it seems to be doing pretty well. The problem is Nintendo is not moving a lot of Wii U game consoles, and not a lot of people have the console to play that game, even though it's a fantastic game. What Nintendo did introduce this week that's kind of interesting is these figures called Amiibo. They're going to be little figurines that will interact with the video games, kind of like Skylanders, kind of like Disney Infinity. They're little collectible figurines of your Mario, your Donkey Kongs that you will be able to connect to your Wii U console that already has the hardware built in to do that. For the Nintendo 3DS portable console, you'll have to get an attachment to do that, but it basically wirelessly connects with them and brings those figures into your games where you can, you know, interact with them, you know, level them up, that sort of thing.
Briefly, I think of the big releases you talked about, the $60 games as targeted towards young men. Is there any attempt to capture, you know, a Generation X nostalgia market out there?
It's funny, you know, I mean, I grew up on video games as well. I grew up on PC games. The thing that got me most excited, I think, in all of these presentations was there's going to be an HD remake of a game called Grim Fandango for the PlayStation 4 and the PlayStation Vita. And that was a kind of an adventure game from, I believe, the 90s, and a very, very great Day of the Dead-themed adventure game from Tim Schafer back in the day. And they're going to kind of re-release this, kind of remake it in HD. You know, but that's something that, you know, if you're an old school gamer, that's something that's pretty exciting. The other thing that we haven't talked about is not a lot of women in these presentations, not a lot of women on stage, not a lot of women represented in the video games. I think that's a huge problem in games that needs to be addressed. And I really didn't see a lot in any of these presentations that shows we're making a lot of progress on that front.
We'll leave it there for now. Omar, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. A lot of fun. Appreciate it.
That's Omar Gayaga, technology culture reporter for the Austin American Statesman. It seems like we've all had one of those moments. Something happens that's so unlikely, so unusual, we can't believe we just experienced it. Maybe we rolled snake eyes 5 times in a row, or bumped into a hometown friend we hadn't seen in years halfway around the world. When it happens, we think of these as being once-in-a-lifetime events. But our next guest says unlikely events happen all the time. In fact, they must happen all the time. In his book, he explains how the laws of probability can actually explain why the highly improbable is actually commonplace. And by understanding how these laws work, we can maybe use probability for our own benefit. We'll take a look back at a conversation we had with David Hand, Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and Senior Research Investigator at Imperial College London. He's the author of The Improbability Principle, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
So when we encounter one of these weird coincidences in our life, we're tempted to chalk it up to fate or maybe divine intervention. Should we slow down on looking for that kind of a supernatural meaning?
I think that's a very nice way of putting it, and I think that's exactly right. Rather than first saying, there is no explanation for this, somebody must be controlling my life, we should do the calculations, as it were, maybe not actually do the maths, but think about the possibilities. And I think, as is explained in the book, we'll find that these sorts of events are, in fact, commonplace. We should, in fact, expect these, what appear to be extremely improbable events, to happen.
You call your book and your explanation The Improbability Principle. You weave together a bunch of different facets of that. But in general, what do you mean by the improbability principle?
In a sentence, I describe it as extremely improbable events are commonplace. Which sounds like a contradiction, of course, because surely if something is extremely improbable, you don't expect to see it very often, so how can it be common? That's the essence of the improbability principle, and the 5 laws which, as you say, weave together to make the principle are different ways that different sort of things which come together to influence that sort of occurrence of the improbable occurring.
One of the things that struck me, one of the facets you talk about, is the law of truly large numbers. And it made me think, okay, if I right now started flipping a quarter 100 times and everyone came up heads, I'd be pretty awestruck. That would be amazing. But how does the law of large numbers change the lens that I should look at that through?
That's a very nice example. A perfect example. Yes, if you flip a coin and it comes up 100 times in a row, heads 100 times in a row, you would be amazed. But suppose I tell you, well, in fact, I flipped the coin 5 million times, and at flip number 1,002,337, that's when my sequence of 100 heads started. You wouldn't be at all surprised that in my 5 million hits, in my 5 million flips, somewhere there had occurred a sequence of 100 heads. If you take enough opportunities, which is what the truly large numbers refer to, if you take enough opportunities, you expect such strange occurrences to occur.
And without delving too deeply into the math there, the probability of me doing that in my first 100 flips, I imagine, is much lower than it happening at some point in that first 10 million flips.
That's exactly right. It's very, you can actually work out the probability that it will happen in the first 100 flips, but I won't. Yeah, but if you keep going for long enough, you stack up those truly large numbers, you should expect it to occur. Now, the point about the law really is that often those truly large numbers are hidden from us. When we discover that something very unusual has happened to someone, we don't think, well, come on, there are 7 billion people on the world. We'd expect this sort of thing to happen.
And that a little detour, I think you call it the gambler's fallacy or something, a kind of magical thinking where If I flip that coin 99 times and it's been heads, oh, for next time for sure it's got to be tails, because probability, what are the odds it'll be 100 times in a row? What's wrong with that way of looking at it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very nice example. We all know that if you flip a coin, then around half the time it will come up heads and half the time it will come up tails. So surely if it's come up lots of heads in a row, the chance must be more that it will come up tails next time. But let me give you a nice little illustration of why that's wrong. Suppose you did that. You flipped the coin lots and lots of times, like the 100 flips we were talking about before. And you keep doing that until it comes up, say, 20 times or 99 times heads in a row. You just keep going however many million flips it takes until you get a sequence of 99 heads. Then you put it in your pocket and you go and find a friend and you say, tell you what, I'll flip this coin and I'll bet you it'll come up tails. If you could do that, if the coin really was more likely to come up tails, you could win any amount of money by doing it in that way, by preparing your coin. And that's clearly ludicrous. You can't do that. The coin doesn't actually remember the flips, you know, the way the flips have come up before. That's the point about the gambler's fallacy. It doesn't remember it. I think the thing to remember is that in any 100 flips of the coin, there is only one way that all coins can come up heads. There's one way that all coins can come up, all 100 flips can come up tails. There are lots and lots of ways that they can come up roughly a half heads and half tails. So it's overwhelmingly more likely that you'll get roughly a half heads and roughly half tails. Very occasionally, however, you'll get one of these more extreme events.
If I can segue over from math to a hint of biology here, is there something about us as humans that we want to see that connection? We want to think the coin remembers and is acting in a certain way?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, the improbability principles tied up with human behavior and the way we perceive things. I mean, when we do observe, your sort of opening type of example illustrates this. When you're thinking of somebody and then the phone rings and it's them, you think, gosh, wow, what an amazing coincidence. But you don't notice all the times that you're thinking of someone and the phone rings and it's not them. Because why should you notice them, those events? So the ones which have some sort of meaning for us, which we would regard as coincidences, are enhanced in our minds. They seem more striking than they really should.
Is that leading us into another one of the laws you talk about, the law of selection?
The law of selection is a rather more subtle law, than the law of truly large numbers. This is a particularly interesting one, though, which basically says you can make things as likely as you want if you choose after the event. Here's a very simple example of this, which I think will probably be familiar to you. You're walking along a country lane, and you come across a barn, and in the side of the barn, there are a lot of painted targets, and in the center of each target, there's an arrow. And you think, gosh, this guy's a really hot archer. Then you carry on walking, you turn around and look at the other side of the barn, and what you see there is a number of arrows sticking in the side of the barn, and a man with a paint pot painting arrows around the targets. He's chosen after the event, and he's made sure that the probability of getting those arrows in the centers of the target is one.
And is that
selected after the event? You know.
And that's the same thing where we remember the dream that came true, but not the 99 that didn't, or the astrologer makes 100 predictions and really makes a big deal about the two they got right.
That's right. Like Gene Dixon, a famous American psychic who predicted 4 years before he was elected that a Democrat, before Kennedy was elected, that a Democrat would be elected who would then die or would be assassinated or die in office. A very good prediction. Mm-hmm. But then you also learn that she predicted that the first man to walk on the moon would be from the Soviet Union, and that the Third World War would break out in 1958. Basically, what she did was drew attention to the predictions she's got right and ignore all the ones she got wrong. And, of course, people would subconsciously collude in this. I mean, why would they pay attention to things she didn't get right? But things she did get right, you'd look at them and think, wow, is there something in this?
Well, that draws it to attention to the difficulty of predicting the future, but maybe also the dangers of predicting the past. I mean, I could go back and 100% accurately explain why 9/11 was going to happen, why World War II was going to start, the recession of 2008. The hindsight can throw us off, can't it?
You are absolutely right. This is a very, very important point. It's very easy to predict the past and say, ah, yes, that led to that, which led to that, which led to that, which led to this. But doing it in the future, there are so many things that could happen, so many ways it could go. 9/11 is a really nice example, because there are sort of people who say, well, you know, it was obvious. If you look back, you can see that, it was obvious that this was going to happen. Yes, looking back, but there is just no way you could have done it looking forward. Alan Greenspan was asked a similar thing about the financial crash. Didn't you see it coming? Why didn't anybody warn us? And he said, yes, of course, we saw it coming. We saw all sorts of things coming. We just didn't know which was the right one. We didn't know which way it was going to pan out.
We're hearing from David Hand about why seemingly improbable and impossible events actually happen every day. You can join the online conversation by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Has an improbable event happened in your life? How do you explain it? We continue our conversation with David Hand, author of The Improbability Principle, about why amazing coincidences actually are happening all the time. Has an improbable event happened in your life? How do you explain it? Share your stories with us on the Central Time Facebook page. David, before we go to our callers, I want to talk about some practical applications or ways this can make things difficult in the scientific world. You talk about disease clusters in your book. How does our analysis of probability make it difficult to figure out if there's just random chance or if there's a real outbreak with a real cause?
Yeah, that's a very nice example, because if you just randomly distribute, if you just drop a lot of ball bearings or grains of sand on a piece of paper, randomly distribute them, some of them will just form clusters by chance. And that's the point about disease clusters. You would expect to get some of these sorts of clusters by chance. So it's a rather subtle area of statistics determining whether the sorts of clusters one does see for diseases are just due to chance or, in fact, have some underlying common cause, like pollution, local source of pollution or something, or a disease outbreak, for instance. It's quite an advanced area of statistics, and it's a tough problem because you would get these rare events, these rare clusters by chance.
And you don't want to ignore the real cause if there is one, but you don't want to get distracted by random distribution.
That's right. And you don't want to cause panic by telling people that there's a disease outbreak when there isn't. Yeah.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Bill with us in Columbus. Bill, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to ask how the word coincidence fits in with your thesis. Here's my story. I was stationed with the Marines in Japan in 1975. We had a squadron picture taken. A guy in that picture gets out of the Marines, joins the Army later on, gets sent to Germany, and is sitting in an enlisted club. And my brother sits down and they two at the same table and they start talking. And this guy, Marty, pulls out a photograph, shows it to my brother, and I am in the photograph.
Yeah.
And almost everybody I talked to has at least one strange story like that.
David, we do all have that story.
Sorry?
We do. A lot of people have that story. How unusual is that?
That's right. Funnily enough, I have a friend who is a catastrophist. I think he's the only catastrophist I've ever come across. He's an expert on catastrophes. He has a similar sort of story about going to visit Singapore, which his family had no connection with. His parents had never been there, and visiting an exhibition in Singapore and seeing a photograph of his father on the wall in this exhibition in Singapore. I think that's right. I think everybody has coincidence sort of stories. But the point really is, and I think this is, the various laws of the improbability principle can come into play. But again, one of them which would come into play with these sorts of things is the law of truly large numbers. You travel around all your life, you go to various places, you see all sorts of different things. The chances of coming across some event like this, there are so many possibilities. And of course, one tends not to notice all the others, the things which, the many millions of things which don't attract your attention, don't make you think that's the same as that or whatever. So the ones which do seem that much more striking.
So all the times we met random people who showed us a picture of people we had no idea who they were, out of all of those, eventually we're going to encounter. And also, you mentioned the law of near enough in your book. Is this a near enough case? It wasn't him. It was his brother.
Ah, that's very good. Yes, that's exactly right. That's right. If it had been a photograph of exactly the same person, you would say, my goodness. But then if it was your brother, you say, my goodness. What about if it was your cousin or your parents or a friend from work or whatever? We can expand the scope quite a lot. And any example from this, we would regard as a coincidence, but by expanding it in this way, we're increasing the chance of observing this sort of thing.
Thanks a lot for the call and that example, Bill. We'll go now to Pat in River West. Pat, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was a bike racer, this is about 30 years ago, and I was with two other bike race team members, and we were in a hotel like in Manila, Illinois. It's a little town to race in a bike race there, and we realized all of our mom's names was Helen. And, you know, that's pretty on those cute.
Yeah, yeah. The law of truly large numbers applies. You know, if you take a group of a handful of three, four, whatever people, and look at their mother's names, well, there are so many sets of four people in the world. You know, if the chance that you would be that there would be such a set with the certain mothers who had the same names is very high. It would be amazing if there was no such set. That doesn't detract from, and this is an important point, that doesn't detract from the sense, just because you do the calculations and say, yeah, well, we'd expect this sort of thing to happen. And, of course, when it happens, you remember it. And, you, for instance, you've remembered it, and you're telling me about it. All the other people to whom it didn't happen don't remember it, and obviously. But it's something you notice, so it grows in importance. And that's, I think this is important. One can do the calculations and say, yeah, you would think it would happen. It's not really that surprising in retrospect when you look at all the possibilities. But that doesn't mean it's not a wonderful and striking thing. The sense of wonder is still there, even if we do the maths.
So you're not a killjoy.
That's right.
Well, how can we apply this in our daily lives? We can't use the improbability principle probably to make winning stock tips or pick the right lottery number, but can we change it to the way we think about those things?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, the book does tell you, in fact, how to increase the amount you win on the lottery should you win. It also tells you how to increase the chance that you will win the lottery. Also, there is an example in there of how to guarantee you will win the lottery. having said that, you know, these are not strategies that I would necessarily recommend. There is also an illustration in there of how you can perfectly predict stock market moves. Again, that's of rather dubious morality, and I wouldn't recommend anybody take it up. But what the book's really about is fundamentally, it's about how the universe works. It's telling us we should expect these apparently highly improbable events. And there are ways you can use it to think about things. It can change your sort of approach to the way you think about things so that you get more insight into what's happening.
Well, there are places where maybe we could be more skeptical. We hear about hot hands in sports stars or a hot hand in gambling maybe, or somebody who's a really solid stock picker. Should we maybe not be so quick to jump on that kind of bandwagon and maybe think about whether it's just the improbability principle at work?
Yeah, let's take the stock pickers first. I mean, that's right. You take the suppose we had a 1,000-odd different stock pickers, and we tested them over 10 weeks. Is it going up or down over 10 weeks? So 10 times, is it going up or down? You'd expect about one of them to get it all 10 right, just by chance, even if it was totally random. You'd expect about one of them to get it all wrong, all 10 wrong, just by chance. You'd expect lots of them, just by chance, to get lots right, half right and half wrong, around half right. But if you did that with all of these 1,000, and you found the guy who had gotten all 10 right, and you ignored all the others, and you looked back just at his scores over the last 10 weeks, you would think, this guy is really hot. And then, of course, if you start to place your money using his recommendations, you'll rapidly discover that he was, in fact, no better than chance. He was just the one who happened to come out first because somebody must, and by chance, he was the one who got all right.
Before we're done, do you have a personal improbability story that struck you that you're a mathematician too, obviously, but that got you interested in the concept of improbability?
This is something I've been, as a statistician, I've been sort of thinking about these things for a long time. So there are various things which happened to me, collecting sorts of anecdotes and things which happened to me. But one happened just a couple of years ago, in fact. I went to the Royal Statistical Society conference in Telford, a town in the UK. I went up to the reception desk to register. I said, my name's David Hand. The receptionist said, but you've already registered. I said, no, after a moment's doubt, I said, no, I haven't. She said, oh, I see. There's another, you're the second David Hand here this week. There are two David Hands with us this week. And then she said, and which one are you? to which I, in a rare moment of quick thinking, said, well, of course, I'm the real one. She unfortunately sighed and said, they all say that. But then I did a calculation, and for instance, in America, this happened in the UK, but had it happened in America, there are about 300 David Hands in America. So you can do the calculation and work out that during the course of my life, it's not really that surprising. I move around a bit, go to conferences, meet lots of people. Not really that surprising that I should encounter another person with the same name.
Well, I'm glad we got the real David Hand on the air with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
That was David Hand, Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and Senior Research Investigator at Imperial College London. His book is called The Improbability Principle, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. Coming up next, yard sales and flea markets are in full swing, and we're going to hear your best finds ever. You can call in now to share with us your best ever yard sale bargain at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Yard sale and flea market season is in full swing, and who doesn't love to brag about their greatest finds, that awesome bargain? Right now, we want to hear from you. What is your greatest thrift or yard or garage sale find ever? Where'd you find it? How much did it cost? Tell us your story. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. That's 800-642-1234. A shout-out for inspiration to the Portage, Wisconsin Flea Festival, an annual event happening this weekend. We'll take your calls in just a moment at 800-642-1234. To kick us off, we've got Central Time producer Chris Molina in the studio. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Rob.
So we talked about thrift finds in the office. You had one right off the top of your head, your typewriter.
Yeah, definitely. So a couple of years back, I was at a garage sale over on the east side of Madison, and I had a friend at the time who had told me, I would really like a typewriter. I think it'd be fun to have one to write letters back and forth to people with. So I said, you know, I'd keep an eye out for her, and I found this, you know, old powder blue Smith Corona typewriter at this garage sale, and it was $2. And I'm thinking, all right, you know, I'll pick it up. If it works, great. If it doesn't,
$2.
It's $2, exactly. Took it home. The thing worked perfectly. The ribbon was great.
Wow.
So I kept the thing for myself, selfishly. I was planning on giving it to the friend, and then I kind of fell in love with the thing. And I've still promised this friend, if I find another one at a garage sale, it's hers.
So you didn't hide the typewriter from your friend?
I did not. Okay. She has used it a couple of times. I guess, you know, maybe she has half custody on the typewriter, but I can't give that thing up. I love it too much.
How do you plug it into the internet?
I haven't quite figured that out yet, but once I do, you know, I think maybe I'm onto a money-making opportunity there.
Well, bring it into work.
All right.
You can type up some of our on-air copy.
You can do the script on there. I think that's a good idea.
Well, let's we'll maybe hear more about the typewriter, but let's hear from our listeners now at 800-642-1234. You can share your best yard sale, garage sale, rummage sale, whatever you want to call it, finds. 800-642-1234. We'll go to Cole with us in Watertown. Cole, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What was your yard sale find?
Definitely probably wasn't my best purchase, but one of the funnier ones, when I was a little kid, I was out looking for a Mother's Day gift. Mm-hmm. I was pretty young, so I came across this, I thought it was just a cool-looking pot, and when I gave it to my mother, she just kind of laughed, and I found out later on that it was actually an ashtray, and my mom doesn't smoke, so it was just kind of a funny little mishap there.
Well, I bet she kept it for a while, even though she didn't put it to the intended use.
You know, she did, actually. I found it years later, I think, up in the attic.
So it was worth keeping. Even though it wasn't the perfect gift, it did come from the heart.
Yep. Absolutely.
Cole, thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm trying to remember if I bought things as a kid at a yard sale. Do you, Chris?
Yeah, I remember, well, you know, my parents were both, you know, yard sale and garage sale fans, so I got, you know, taken to a bunch as a kid, and I don't remember, you know, what I bought, but I remember, you know, because you have, as a kid, you know, 10 or 15 cents in your pockets, and, you know, you can end up with, I think Happy Meal toys were kind of popular, those, back when Happy Meal toys were actually, like, cool little action figures and things, not the, I don't know what they are now, but I don't think they're nearly as cool.
Landfill.
Right.
My dad went through a phase of getting, you know, those rotary lawnmowers, which I use now.
Oh, yeah.
At garage sales. They're always dull. I don't know if we ever sharpened them. I mowed the lawn, and getting those things through over the septic field where the grass is super long and thick. Yeah. Running start. Run. Yeah, so I kind of cursed yard sales for a while thanks to those. Well, thanks, Cole, for the call. We'll go now to Dan in Madison. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I should preference this by I'm a completely uncoordinated person.
Okay.
All right? And this is a bad yard sale experience, but it's precious. My son was about 5 years old. He wanted to get me something for Father's Day, and he had a dollar. And we were at this community wide garbage sale, and there was a pair of rollerblades on my side. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I really like these, but they're $5, you only have a dollar. The wonderful lady on the other side of the counter said, oh, for your daddy. Okay, well, yeah, they're a dollar. We're marking them down. I had stitches. I hurt my shoulder. I ripped up a pair of pants. And I absolutely loved the memory.
Oh, yeah, but you couldn't not use them, could you, after all that?
No, but I was very, very entertaining to them.
Dan, thank you so much for sharing that story, and I'm glad you survived the experience.
Yeah, I remember bicycles were always kind of a big thing at garage sales, and I always remember wanting to jump on the bike, but never wanting to get into an accident or anything. But I've heard some horror stories. Yeah. Luckily, I haven't seen any.
Get it tuned up first. Thank you so much for that story. We'll go now to Joe in Milwaukee. Actually, before we take Joe, I'll let a line opened up. We're looking for your best ever flea market finds, yard sale, garage sale, rummage sale. Why do we have so many words for the same thing? Your best yard sale bargains or stories. 800-642-1234 is the number. We've got Joe on the line in Milwaukee now. Joe, hi.
Hi. Back in 1973, I just had graduated from Purdue, and I was really interested in a more back then pocket calculators had just come out. And there was a garage sale right down the street from my mom in Indianapolis, and went down there just to see what they had. And there on the table was a $800 Hewlett-Packard. It was programmable. You could make these little, look like chewing gum sticks. You would run through it, and you could have all these special calculations. And, doing the math today, back then the a starting engineer got $1,000 a month, so this thing probably in today's dollars was worth about $4,000 or $5,000.
Wow. And how much did you lay out for it?
$15.
All right, that's a score. How long did you use that HP calculator?
I used it for about 3 or 4 years, and then one of the keys quit working. It was going to be about $300 to get it fixed. And so I still have the calculator, but and the memory. But the thing that was the second neat part, there was a part missing, which was a charger. And so I went to a bookstore up in South Bend at Notre Dame, and I went in there and I said, "You wouldn't happen to have the power supply, whatever?" And they said, "Well, actually, someone stole the calculator, and I have everything else here." $50.
So maybe you ended up with the hot property there.
Well, no, actually, I said, "Hey, I just got this. If it's stolen, I don't want it." And they ran the serial numbers, and it showed it was a legal, unreported thing. So I had basically got a completely new calculator and all the parts and pieces. And so I, like I said, had it for many years, and it was quite a memory piece because, that was that was probably the top of the line calculator at that time.
State of the art, and your conscience is clear. Joe, thanks a lot for the call.
You know, one thing that call reminded me of was sometimes when you buy something at a garage sale or a yard sale, it's cool when you get it, but then you don't realize what's going to happen, all these stories that you get after the fact. Mm-hmm. So when I got this typewriter, I told my mom about it like a week later, and it turns out she has pretty much the exact same one at home. So we kind of got it into our heads that we were going to start writing letters to each other on our matching typewriters. Well, it turns out that the ribbon in hers had gone gone dead like 25 years earlier. We bought another ribbon online, tried to get it in there, totally, you know, destroyed the thing. So, and it's hard finding replacement parts, but it's something that I know we both, you know, really want to do going forward to try to get that thing working and kind of, you know, fulfill this promise that we made to each other at one point that we're going to start writing letters to each other.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
Yeah.
So you'll share them with us.
Of course.
Great. All right, we'll go back to our callers now. We've got Gail on the line in Oregon. Gail, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. It's not about something I found. It's about something we sold.
Okay.
And we just had a garage sale this last weekend, only it wasn't a garage sale. We didn't call it a yard sale. We called it a man sale because my husband sold all kinds of tools and electric parts. He cleaned out his workshop. And so we set it up in the garage, no prices. But we put signs all over our village called, just said the man sale.
Did anybody show up looking to buy a man?
Yes. Several women came in, and I said the only thing I had left was this factory second guy over here, and yeah. I don't do trade-ins.
Only for rent.
Yeah, exactly. And somebody did buy him, and they brought him back, so that was too bad. But, no, we had a lot of women came in looking for something for Father's Day.
Oh,
We had kids coming in looking for Father's Day, but we had all these guys stopping, and we had it on Craigslist and these sales. And then no prices. So my husband's an old used car sales guy. He was having a ball, you know, bartering and whatever. So we sold just about everything. The rest of it we took to Habitat Restore. But we had people driving by to take photos of the man sale.
That's great. Thank you, Gail. And I'm glad that panned out for you. We've got a comment from Carrie on Facebook. She says, it's so hard to choose, but it's either my unused tabletop plastic greenhouse for $2, that's a bargain, or the 70s kitchen chairs I'm now reupholstering. Six for $15. So those are cheap chairs, worth a little reupholstering work.
I wish I knew where all these sales were. It sounds like there's some, you know, great stuff that's out there just waiting to be found.
Yeah, but are you going to reupholster those?
Probably not, learning a new skill is always a good thing.
We'll go back to our callers now. Jordan on the line in Madison. Briefly, Jordan, not much time left. What was your find?
All right, briefly, I don't know if this can be considered a bargain or an investment, but I was traveling with some friends. We were down in Mobile, Alabama, and I just saw this really cool chest at a garage sale, and I thought it would just be a great addition to my place as an antique item. When I got home, I started inspecting it a little bit, and I noticed that it had some pretty cool-looking coins in there. So I took it to a local coin shop, and they told me that the coins that I found in my chest were valued at about $5,000. So I actually turned in the coins, and I got $5,000 for them. And
But Jordan, I got to cut in, but watch out for the pirate curse. We're out of time.
Wow.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Rob.
Now back to work. Thank you for all the great calls, and you can share your finds, your thrift store finds, garage sale finds on the Central Time Facebook page.